changes or amendments to the agenda today to propose? Are there any changes or amendments to the agenda? Hearing none, a motion to approve the agenda would be in order. Moved by Deputy Mayor McLeod, seconded by Councilor Fisk. Any discussion? Everybody for the question? All those in favor of the motion? It is unanimous, thank you. Under 1.2, we have approval of minutes for the last committee of the whole meeting, November 21st. Are there any errors or omissions in those minutes? Whoever may have something turned on, it would be advisable, please turn it off. A motion to approve the minutes of the last committee of the whole meeting for November 21st would be in order. Moved by Councilor Frelick, seconded by Councilor Fancy. Any discussion? Everybody for the question? All those in favor of the motion? It is unanimous, thank you. Under 1.3, public comment session. Is there anyone in the public gallery that would like to speak this morning? Please state your name, your address, and limit your comments to 5 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We are on the College Street, Liverpool. It's a short agenda, so I'll be short this morning. Just one thing I'd like to say here to the new CAO, Chris McNeil. Previous employee here in her capacity. I think you probably made a good choice there. I know Chris quite well. He's a good kind of person now, and has lived here for a number of years. So we'll look forward to seeing him in the chair. That's it. The other item the only item on your agenda is your presentation there for the final club. We have Jason and Trevor here. I had the opportunity to speak to them briefly prior to the meeting because afterwards I realized you people will have that coming. Over, so I had a chance to talk to them, and I'll be interested to see what they say.
Thank you, Leon. Any other member of the gallery may like to speak today? Thank you very much. We will move on to 2.0. Our presentation under 2.1 is by Nova Scotia Power employees Jason Liver and Trevor Beaton. We're pleased to have them here this morning, and I will turn the meeting over to you for presentation.
So I'll start with saying thank you for letting us have the opportunity to speak here. We're always happy to talk about our veg management program in Nova Scotia Power. Quick introductions. My name is Trevor Beaton. I'm the T&D Shared Services Manager. Part of that is the Forestry Group. Jason Liver is our forester on the distribution side for the full province. So I'm still fairly new to the forestry world. So I'm going to lean on Jason for any technical and standard questions on that stuff, but basically just wanted to say thank you for the opportunity. And any questions forestry related, we're pretty confident we'll be able to handle. Any other comments or questions on Nova Scotia Power, feel free to ask. We'll gladly take away any questions, and Lisa Lane at Nova Scotia Power, I spoke to her yesterday, she'll be happy to follow up with any answers to questions that Jason and I can't handle today, so I'll turn it over to Jason.
Thanks, Trevor. So my presentation today is going to be fairly short, maybe a little high level. I prefer a question and answer type forum. Like I said, any questions that we can't answer, we'll take away and get back. There's about 20 slides in total, and feel free to interrupt throughout the presentation if you want, or you can wait for questions till the end. So at Nova Scotia Power, the veg program has been around for quite a while, but what we want to do is try to introduce our strategies on why we do what we do, and it sort of sets the tone for understanding why we are where we are. So we have our program is broken out into four main components, one being reactive work. So That's the data that comes in from various sources, including customer outages, number of hours customers are out, the frequency of tree-caused outages, etc. That data is compiled and sort of steers us in a direction where we need to put our resources. The second and probably most important is our preventative work. So we have four coordinators that are stationed throughout the province, plus myself, and we have a transmission forester. What we want to do is use our expertise, our knowledge, and get the problems before they actually happen. It's easier said than done because there's a lot of problems out there with a limited resource base, including finances. But we do our best, and we try to get ahead of this the problems before they actually occur. The third is our sustainability program, which means after we've established a right-of-way, we don't want to lose it again. So we have a program in place where we go back on earlier intervals, either through our herbicide program or through ground cutting, mowing. There's various tools that we use to maintain that. And fourth, which is rather new to our program, is our widening initiatives. So really, we're looking at increasing the width of a right-of-way. What we find is over time, when veg falls in on the wires, it's extremely difficult to access the area. So we don't have enough width to see down through the right-of-ways. So what we want to do is widen out what's been sort of an acceptable 10 feet on either side to maybe 20 feet, depending on the veg condition on the edge. If there's a tall slope on, you know, to help prevent trees from falling in, we want to make the right-of-ways wider. That's a tough sell. It works in some areas and it doesn't in others. So you're not going to want us in the town of Liverpool cutting front yard trees that are 15 feet away. So, you know, there's a give and take, and it applies in specific locations. So here's just a kind of a quick pie chart showing, you know, where our resources are allocated. And again, you know, the preventative is what we preach. We want to try to put the most resources into our preventative maintenance program. You know, a dollar today could be $2 tomorrow. So that's kind of our mindset going forward. It's always been that way, but it's really tough sell. You know, when we experience a storm we just did back, not less than a week ago, and we get feedback from customers and our line crews and so on saying, why aren't you in these areas cutting these trees? But, you know, in the preventative sense, we were somewhere else preventing something from happening in a different location. Just, we can't be everywhere at once. So that'll just kind of give you a big picture of where our strategy lies.
So there's probably some widening context that can be given on the widening stuff. In that sense, we're really ramping up just in the last couple of years on the widening across the province. We've had probably roughly around $1 million a year. We've been doing it year over year over year to reestablish or widen right-of-ways. Our budget for 2018 on the widening side is around $15-16 million. We expect to spend roughly $80 million on the distribution side alone over the next 8-10 years, and another 45-55 on the transmission side. So you're going to see that continued focus from NSP over the next anywhere from 5 to 10 years on that. And we've seen through recent storms some really good results from that. In areas we focused on with widening efforts, the outages from especially really the Christmas storm and the storm of January 4th, some really impressive reliability stats from as everybody in here knows, some pretty impressive winds.
Do you own the land where the poles are?
No, and that's a big part of it. So we have easements throughout the province, but the widening, the tough sell that Jason would have discussed, we're trying to widen on people's property. For sale time, so we have an extensive door knocking campaign whenever we're going to go do widening. So we do require that permission. So some customers don't do it. They'd rather the trees remain there and deal with the impact on reliability. Some customers in some probably more rural regions, they're thrilled to lose the trees and gain that increased reliability.
So, just to touch on Trevor's, the widening program has been focused more on the sort of the extents of our feeders, which really gets out to, I wouldn't call it the middle of nowhere, but the customer density is really low. those customers historically have been off for a longer period of time because, of course, you know, you try to get the greatest number of customers on as quickly as you can at the beginning of the storm. But these folks tend to be 3 or 4 days before they get any love. So those are the areas we focused on our widening program simply because the duration is cut down. These areas have been neglected over years, and we'll be the first one to admit that they're not the priority when it comes to tree trimming. You know, the three-phase lines through the towns, we do have a priority pecking order in which we try to follow. But these widening programs have really, really, really helped out a lot as far as duration goes. The access is greater, and the if you can see the problem, you can fix it. So just to show you know, some differences in our structures, this is a transmission line, 230 kV and a 345 kV. As you can see, we're not looking at, you know, widening our distribution lines to this extent, but because of the interconnectivity of the grids, we're also under some NERC regulations as well to maintain the forest floor and maintain a minimum width. If there's a tree caused outage on some of these lines that are NERC controlled, we'd be looking at some major fines, and so we try to prevent that from happening. But this is just a snap of a 240 and a 345 kV line. This is something you probably can relate to a little more. This is a three-phase distribution line. And these are what we call a backbone or a feeder line. So those larger transmission lines feed into a substation. And then from the substation, we have three-phase power, and they are, it's like the circulatory system in your body. It delivers the power to the rest of your extremities. The folks that I just referenced to our widening program, they would be more of like a single-phase line, for example, but this would be the backbone. This is kind of where our concentration has been for years, and we're just now starting to move a little more focus to the single-phase distribution line, which looks like this. Now, if we had all our single-phase distribution lines looking like this one, we wouldn't have many problems. But this is a picture-perfect scenario, and as you can see, there's some alders on the bottom left, which we consider a compatible species, and we encourage that through some of our veg activities. So to touch on a question that was asked to us earlier, where we work and how do we decide on where we work is dictated much on the vegetation condition that's in the field. We have some areas that are worse than others. We have some areas that have been worked on for years and are in a sustainability mode. So we go back there every year. We don't want to lose that right of way. So we keep investing money in those right of ways when to somebody else, they may look at it and say, it looks like a waste of money. Why are you spending money on vegetation that's only, you know, waist height when we have areas that are burning? Well, if we didn't spend that money on those areas to sustain them, it would just get repeat itself. It's just a cycle. We try to break that cycle. It takes a lot of work and a lot of effort. But almost every kilometer of line in the province has been driven by either a coordinator, a lineman, somebody who feeds back information to give us the vegetation condition, and then we map it. So what we want to know is how much or a percentage of the province is in a certain condition, and then apply a dollar value to that over time. Budgets fluctuate from year to year. We don't get a set amount every year, wish I did, but we know that's not reality. So we use this to help guide where we can allocate the dollars at any given year. So I'll go through some of these definitions, like an urban cycle, and this will touch on your point, sir, the question you asked before, was that's like the urban component. That's like, you know, Liverpool, Bridgewater, Halifax, anywhere where there's a, you know, heavy customer density. And we're not going to get the widths that we probably want. You know, we can get away with less distance there because of the density of folks, the response time from our line crews, et cetera. So we're more of on a cycle. We try every 7 years to be through each town on average. Some towns probably 10, some towns maybe 5, but overall we try to get between that 7 and 8 year rotation. Next we have the urban reclamation, and some of these terminologies will change over time, but the urban reclamation is the area just outside of the town. Let's call it the suburbs or cottage country, places like that where, you know, there is an urban component because of the customer density, but maybe the taste for letting us widen that right of way is a little more robust, and we can get away with ground cutting. We can get away with the 10 feet without much resistance. Then we go into the rural reclamation. This is where some of our widening areas take place. These are the areas that are, like I mentioned before, at the edges of the feeder that maybe are, you know, 30 miles from a substation that didn't tend to get the maintenance rotations like some of the other classification types. And then we touched, like I said earlier, on the sustainability program, which is what we're trying to increase. We're trying to increase the volume of kilometers that are in that sustainability mode because they're cheaper in the long run to maintain. You know, I'll just throw some quick numbers at you. You know, the widen, it's roughly around $1,200 a span or $21,000 a kilometer. To maintain a kilometer of line that's in a stable condition, it's a fraction of that. We're talking $5,000 a kilometer. So the more of that you can put in, over time you're going to save money. So we've you know, like most corporations, we lean heavily on some of the technology that's available to us, and this is a real success story as far as forestry is concerned with our project mapping. We have a lot of apps that help us out. We have smart devices. We have all kinds of things to lend a helping hand, and we use this technology to track our progress and hold our contractors accountable. And maybe even just show you know, the progress of a project. Once this work is digitized, we have it forever, and we use this to help project where we're going to be next. So this data is stored in a repository, and given a bunch of fields, you know, this is an urban, you know, this is the town of Liverpool. We just did this in 2016, 2017. So these are the points where we felt there was trees in contact or vegetation in conflict with our wires, and we had a physical point taken in the field and an inventory collected as to what needed to get done. So now next time we come through, we have this as a data source. So we now know how much it cost to do this trimming. We know how long it took. We know how many resources it took. So this will help predict what we need again 7 or 8 years from now after you know, we figure in the growth rates for some of the trees that that grow in an urban environment. Here's a snap of Queens County. I try to customize these presentations to fit the audience, and you know, instead of showing the whole province, I just wanted to show what we've done in Queens County for the last just since 2016. So I should have probably put the numbers on the edge here, but there's been 58 kilometers of line done in this area in the last year, which is fairly substantial in the grand scheme of things over the entire province. So we have identified this area as some areas with that really needed it. Caledonia area, we invested a lot of money up in that area to try to improve the reliability in that neck of the woods. We extended the town of Liverpool's project. Initially, we were just going to do the municipality. We ended up doing up Highway 8 and then heading east towards Liverpool East. So, and we're not done. We still have more work to do. So we do this in each quadrant of the province as best we can, because there's a need all over the province. We just don't start in one end and sweep across. Yes, sir.
By doing the 58 kilometers, does that mean at 21,000?
A large portion of that was at the 21,000.
So we're looking over $1 million?
Pretty close to that.
Okay.
Yep. Now the municipality trimming is about 500 a span, or about 17,000 a kilometer. Just to give, you know, some rough averages here. I don't have the exact data, but just to give you high level. So again, to touch on the urban cycle, which is similar to what you'd see in downtown here, you know, this is where we struggle with trying to get the widths that we actually want. And there's a conflict with the aesthetics. You know, the trees don't look natural. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and deny it. When we trim a tree, we do our best to keep the health of the tree in mind. It may look ugly, but we've done some things to it where we know we're not going to impact its long-term health. You know, 30% of the crown of a tree is kind of the rule of thumb. We end up removing roughly 30%. We put the tree in a situation where it's under undue stress. It's more stress than the tree can handle, and then it's susceptible to other diseases, insects, and you start seeing a downward decline. You know, of course, there's going to be controversy as far as, you know, what's 30% of the crown of the tree? Is it one large limb? Is it the overall structure of the tree diminished? But these guys, you know, that we hired to do this, some of them are trained arborists, some of them are not. They're still in training. But they have a continuing education program where, you know, arboriculture is at the forefront of their teachings, and they do their very best to make sure that the cuts are correct and arboriculturally sound. And again, we try to balance that with aesthetics and, again, the clearances that the power company is, you know, demanding of these guys based on some of the specs, I'm sure, that were shared that I sent around earlier. This is, you know, maybe this could be considered cottage country, but in the past, we just focus on the aerial. We just trim out what's above. You know, we're focusing now on trying to get the vegetation out from underneath. Some trees are just incompatible with power, you know, and it's a balance between what the customer wants and what we think the customer needs as far as giving them a reliable power source. Here's where it gets a little ugly. It's the rural reclamation. This is the widening program we're talking about. You know, the picture on the left shows years of just topping, just taking a limb off, just snip it. It doesn't gain you anything. It gets you your clearances, but it doesn't give you the access to the right of way when a tree does fall in from the outside, or a line crew has to show up and splice the wire back together. It takes so much longer to fix a line in this condition than when you can see it. The picture on the right is a manual approach. So we have guys that have trucks that come through and make it safe, and then we have ground cutters, and that's all they do is they just drop stubs and they buck up the wood and they stack as best they can. And then over time, the veg comes back, and we try to influence what grows back through our herbicide program. So from a province-wide standpoint, we try to hit around 200 kilometers every year of some sort of a mechanical approach. So, you know, we have mowers, we have harvesters. You see the DOT folks mowing the edge of the highways. Well, we have those same machines. We have trucks come through and we top out the trees to make them safe, and then the mower comes in and mows it down. So you have a picture on the left showing, you know, before we got there, this is from the same vantage point, and then we have a picture on the right showing the end result. You know, during an ice storm, I don't know which one the line crews would pick, but I'm pretty sure it would be the right-handed one. But it's the eye of the beholder. So what looks good to me may not look good to somebody else, and that's the balance we keep trying to strike. There's a few pictures of some of the machines we use. Some of them are quite large, some of them are smaller. But they get a lot of work done in a short period of time, so we're able to cover a lot of ground. There are restrictions as to where they can work. You know, during the springtime, we can't float these machines. They'll rot everything up and sink out of sight in some areas. But, you know, during the summer months, we've been really lucky. We covered an awful lot of ground this fall. We had a fantastic trimming season, let's call it that, and we got a lot of work done with these machines. And then there's areas where we have the ability to, stack the wood. This is done by a single grip harvester, so it's got a processing head on the front, and it delims and bucks the wood, and we stockpile. And either we land, it's always the landowner's wood, it's not ours. So what we do is we arrange with the landowner, what do you want done with it? This particular landowner wanted it stacked roadside so he could access it himself with his forwarder. So we make individual arrangements with each property owner based on where they want the wood. There's times when we've trucked wood kilometers to put it in their log yard. So, you know, that's the trade-off that we try to do. Instead of pursuing easements and costs associated to that, we felt the approach was to work with each individual landowner, and everyone understands the value this provides back, and in exchange for that, we're willing to do a lot of things that maybe aren't standard. So this is ultimately what we're what we're gunning for. This is what we call a natural stable ecology, which is you know, it's alders, maybe not the most pretty shrub out there, but what it does, it prevents incompatible trees from growing up through. It's a species that can choke out things underneath and shade them and keep the birch and the maple and the poplar and things like that from shooting up through. Now, once in a while, you will get one that will poke up through. And this is where we drive by and we hop out and cut that one tree. It's we call it a low-cost option, and you can cover hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of this type of work for a very, very low cost, maybe $20 a span. So we're trying to encourage this sort of thing because we think in the long term it's going to save us so much more. And herbicides are obviously a, can be a touchy subject from time to time, and I think we don't hide it. We say we do it. We follow all the rules laid out by the Nova Scotia Environment. Our contractors are trained. They have to have certificates in order to apply pesticides. Again, it's very selective. So what we do is we choose products that aren't broad spectrum. There are instances where we will use broad spectrum herbicides, but what we try to do is select an herbicide that won't kill grasses. They're very species specific. We target individual trees with backpacks, so there isn't a broadcast spray. And then there's times when we just treat stumps. So the tree is cut and a small amount of product is applied to the stump, and then the stump is the resprouts are retarded from the spray. You still will get some grow back, but it's less dense and less vigor, so it won't grow as fast. So without our herbicide program, our sustainability program would suffer, and I think they go hand in hand, and there's a time and a place for everything. And so we find that our herbicide program in conjunction with the sustainability program work quite nicely. So new construction today, we've realized that we need it wider from the start. So any new construction, we're pushing for a 40-foot total right-of-way, which is 20 feet on either side of the conductor. And this is a three-phase, like we explained before, a backbone, sort of a primary source. And from the beginning, we need to establish this right-of-way. Maybe years ago, and 20, 30, 40 years ago, it wasn't quite the understanding that this line's going to be here for 40, 50 years. It's not always going to be a farm. You know, things change. And when the veg grows and we don't have an established right-of-way, we have to resort back to the widening initiatives, which is reestablishing a right-of-way that should have been there in the first place. So that's kind of where we're at right now as far as our veg program goes. And then we do have a tree replacement program. It's not as probably robust as it should, but there are scenarios where it's the best interest for everybody to remove the tree because it's just an incompatible tree. It's the wrong tree in the wrong place. So we can exchange. We can come and cut this tree and get rid of it and replace it with something more compatible free of charge to the customer. We target these trees and then we approach the customer and we try to make an arrangement. So that's it. I don't have much else as far as the big picture is concerned. I know there were some specific concerns around the aesthetics of some of the trimming around Liverpool, in particular Bristol Ave. I believe there were some folks that felt we were a little aggressive in that area. And that's kind of where I wanted to start. Give you a big picture overview of our program and then leave it up for you as a question and answer period.
Councilors have questions or comments this morning? Councilor Crowley?
thank you for the presentation and appreciate what you're doing. However, I was one of the ones that was concerned about the Bristol Avenue. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'll just start with my thoughts about it. We as a region, we do a lot to protect trees. We've had many people come before us and want trees removed, and they're all considered heritage trees. We would never cut one down unless absolutely necessary or just happen. But we do a lot to protect that and to protect trees. And then along comes Nova Scotia Power, and in one or two days, you've taken one of our main streets that historic trees that we've been looking at, we've been photographing, we've been protecting for many, many years. It's part of who we are as a downtown. And literally, you have ripped through, and you talk about aesthetics. I mean, there was no aesthetics with that. There were trees that were completely butchered, like one branch left on the side, and that's our entrance into our main street. My concern is, you know, will you do the same thing on our main street, which is even more, more of a consideration for us, because it is part of, if you look at Lower Main, the area is renowned for people coming through and going to the lighthouse. Are we going to wake up someday and then just have that tree, that street completely butchered? So, I guess my questions are, when you're contemplating this, who do you talk to? Like, do you come into the town? Do you talk to the Heritage Committee? Do you talk to the region? Do you talk to the homeowners? What happens that allows you to literally go through and obliterate all the trees?
So we work in conjunction with, TIR, of course. We operate within their designated road right of way. We make contact with every landowner that we can. So from the questions that I posed to the crews, to the coordinators, prior to this meeting, most landowners were approached and explained of, you know, what the process was. So we didn't just show up and just start without any door knocking. Every property owner is asked, this is what we plan on doing, do you have any concerns? And for the vast majority of folks, they said do what you need to do, which unfortunately is the worst words that we want to hear, because what we want to do and what the landowner feels could be done is going to be starkly different. And this, I don't know if this problem will ever get resolved, but we can do a much better job notifying folks as to when we're coming in advance. We did the town of Yarmouth where we held a meeting similar to this and explained what we were going to do. At the town's request, they wanted us in their town to do this type of trimming. We get a lot of feedback from a variety of folks. I forget the man's last name, but Roger down in Port Mattoon area. I believe he might have been a counselor here last year, year before. So he was one of the folks that requested our presence to do some widening down in his area. So we get a lot of individual requests from a variety of municipal sources. So what you're suggesting is we talk to Heritage folks prior to the coming to identify these trees, or maybe have a street identified as maybe, we can walk it together, look at it a little differently, see what we can and can't do, and maybe not go with standardized approach.
That's exactly what I'm saying, because there are certain areas that this all makes sense. Tree trimming in rural areas, if you're going alongside the road, I don't think you have to be as conscious of that. But when you're affecting a town that relies on tourism and visitors and all of that, we're trying to entice people in, and now those same visitors will come down one of our main streets or a street that gets us into the town. And all the trees are gone on one side, or only one branch left facing the homeowner. I don't think any homeowner would understand the severity of what happened on Bristol.
Right.
When you're talking an individual tree, we want to trim it up. I don't think that anyone thought that was going to be a trimming. That goes to the next extreme, where sometimes it's often better to take the tree down, because I know they're going to grow back. But they're going to grow back in a very weird way, because there's nothing on one side of them. So, and if you look at the other side of the road, we have amazing, beautiful trees on each side, on that side,
mm-hmm.
and stripped on the other.
Right.
So, yeah, that's exactly what I think should happen with, especially on main streets or any really areas of the town that people are concerned. So, a public meeting or a meeting with whoever would be the answer for that.
No, definitely take that back. We're always encouraged to hear back of ways to better manage the message that we're trying to deliver. But again, we look at those areas, and power and trees, they can coexist. It's just the aesthetics is what sometimes takes the second fiddle as far as getting the clearances. potentially flip through. I mean, we look at it from a safety point of view as well. I mean, we have to take that into consideration. Trees do conduct electricity. And from what I observe from driving Bristol Ave and looking at some of the work, there's secondaries that run through there. That's the 240 volts that serve as your home. They can burn down with trees that grow in between the wires and push them together. During little ice storms and stuff, they compress down. So I mean, if you're gonna go there and invest the time and effort and money to establish it for a reliability perspective, we can't be back every year or every 2 years. So we try to gain as much clearance as we can at the time to prevent having to come back. And a lot of the stuff that they did cut was regrowth from a prior trip. So we have been through that area before. I don't know how aggressive. It was probably before my time. They will grow back. There will be sucker sprouts come back from those cuts. It'll take a little bit of time, but you'll see it slowly coming back again. And unfortunately, we'll have to come back to address it again.
That's what I'm worried about.
I don't know what the right answer is, working together is probably the start.
Yeah, we're happy to make every effort if we do come back into. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's on the docket for this year or what it is. But yeah, we'll meet ahead of time. We're more than happy to do that. Like I said, we prefer to do that as opposed to dealing with it retroactively.
Yeah, I have more questions, but you can come back.
Councilor News?
Do you have like a 5-year plan, like this area is like a opportunity or something?
Mm-hmm.
Being clear, do you have a 5-year plan? And is there a number you can call to find out if they're on a plan?
So I've been asked that question a few times. We have what I would say a comfortable 2-year plan. Projecting 5 years out, it can be so variable. And once you commit, I don't like saying, sorry, I said I would, but now I'm not. The 2-year plan can be a little more adjusted from a few months earlier to a few months later. But sometime in that ballpark, I can give you a pretty good answer. Outside of that, depending on where the need is, and like I said, a lot of data feeds into our decision making, and it'll change from year to year. So a priority this year, based on reliability stats, could be completely different 3 years from now. So I'm a little reluctant to hang my hat on a 5-year plan, but I could give you some degree of accuracy within two, for sure.
Councilor Kelly?
It's good to know a lot of this information that you're providing today. And I guess on behalf of Councilor Frelick, the communication piece, as a councilor, I know that I have residents in my district that are concerned about trees. And I may have been calling or putting in requests to have things done. And if I know that you're coming to this area, we can have a conversation. These are our problem areas or our residents to deal with those things when you come here. So you're saying this work that you've done in our area right now is now done and you're moving out, and there's, unless you get the ad hoc, if it's really, really bad, you'll look at it and come back and do it. But if it's not, we're on like the 7-year cycle where you're back in 7 years to actually do some more work here.
Roughly, yeah.
So we missed an opportunity here to sort of clean up, because I know that there's still probably an issue with the tree, which I don't understand, is there's one in my district that the tree is actually growing all around the transformer, if that's what it is. I don't know what it's not just a regular pole, it's got things, lots of things attached to it.
Yep.
So I figure it's important, right?
Yep.
The tree's growing all around it, but nobody seems to want to do, asked about it before. Nothing gets done about it. So I have a problem looking at this tree and thinking, I'm trying to understand why NSP doesn't think that there's anything wrong with that, because it's growing all around. I mean, maybe it's a really strong tree and you never expect the edges to come down, but if they ever did, you're going to wipe out pretty much one end of Liverpool with that.
So I'd love to know where this tree is.
Okay.
And
we'll talk.
This rogue tree out there.
Yeah.
Take care of it. No, but I'd love to see. We're going to be here for a while. I mean, I can pop over even today to take a peek at it. So we have a customer request at work. Order program as well, where if a customer feels a tree is endangering their line, they're free to call. It's, we've increased it from a 3-month program response rate to a 10-day turnaround. At least you'll have somebody come out to scope it, to review the tree, determine its priority, and then make a decision on whether we need to act to do anything. Without seeing the tree, I'm just speculating.
Oh yeah, of course.
But that program is in place for any customer to call and report trees that they feel they need assistance with.
But as counselors, we could call in as well on behalf of customers.
Absolutely.
To let you know about issues in there. See, that's good to know,
yes,
too.
Absolutely.
100%. So I'll get that information from you and make sure that my residents know as well, and I communicate with them that this is what they can do if they have problems with trees. I have another question that might take a little bit longer, but when I see all this about what you're doing above ground, what is the conversation for putting the lines below the ground?
So we do have, there is underground lines in the province, but there was a news release on this not too long ago, actually. The cost to bury power lines, even when you're talking in new construction, is 8 to 10 times more than running them above.
Wow, that's incredible.
It is.
All the money that you spend on, you know, when the power goes out and fixing the lines and the storms and all of that.
So for us to bury all our lines, or 24,000 kilometers worth of lines that aren't buried, would be roughly $20 to $25 billion.
But there's no conversation. Is there a conversation going on in the future that that would become a strategy in the future? There must be a way in the future that this is a possibility.
So I'm not. I don't want to get too deep into it because part of it, but I'll gladly speak a little bit of it. We do look at it in situations. Typically, the lines that are buried underground are new subdivision developments where those costs are borne by the developers.
Right.
Obviously, we can't decide to bury an underground line to the benefit of one area when those costs get distributed across all customers. But yeah, just the actual cost of it, you'd never make that up. And then you 100% have fewer outages. The outages you have are exponentially longer. Because obviously figuring out where the problem is, accessing it, is all probably tenfold. So you will have that a very impressive decrease in the number of outages, the frequency of them, but your duration will go through the roof. So to invest that amount of money into it just wouldn't be like the rate pressure would be I don't want to overuse the word exponential, but it would be like our rate base today is somewhere between $3.5 and $4 billion. So to increase that sixfold isn't for us a feasible approach.
Councilor Kelly, if I may, I'd like to move on to the other show from back.
Again, what you say with this tree cutting program, it's the good, bad, and the ugly with everything you're going to have to do. But I think it's especially with the we know what's happened with Nova Scotia Power over the years. It's cutbacks too, and everything is a business. And to be able to the outages would be so much longer, and such as with less manpower. So all these things are work into a program that has to work. So I appreciate what you're trying to do, you know, but put it in that way. One of the things that always concerns me is I was walking through Pine Grove Park the other day and I saw some pine trees down there. And you look and they see they were all rotten in the middle. So you said, okay, well, I see why they fell, because they were all rotten. And when I go up around, I live in Milton, I go up around the river on the upper end, and see a lot of locust trees.
Yes.
And you see when the wind starts blowing, those locust trees, you're just going to say, when are they coming down? Because they will come down. Mm-hmm. And there's dirt, certain species that have a very shallow root,
mm-hmm.
and some have deep root.
That's right.
And so you know that the eventually something is going to cause you grief.
Yep.
You just can't go in on somebody's land and cut them. But is there ways of testing the trees, or do people look at that and say, and like these trees are eventually gonna bite us, and be able to say, okay, let's do a testing of the tree to find out the health of the tree, and maybe give an option to the homeowner.
Yep. So I've done that personally many times. there's a large number of factors that can feed into the health and structure of the tree. If a tree, you know, a pine tree can live up to 400 years, you know, especially a white pine. Some trees are longer lived than others, like a poplar tree, for example, is a shallow rooter, it is a short-lived species. We target those. White birch is another one we target. You know, sugar maple, oak, we try to encourage because their branch structures are strong. You know, so yeah, there is a lot of science in as far as this tree species selection goes and what we do to some versus others. White pine trees have a very weak branch attachment. So snow loading, the branches snap or fall. So often you see a pine tree that the crown is raised so much higher. There's a reason for that. So yes, to answer your question, we do. We look at the branch where they grow together. We call things called included bark, which is a trigger point for a branch to split off a tree. So we look for those indicators. We look for fungus mushrooms growing on the ground, which is an indicator for root rot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a whole host of things. We try to look at any indicators for diseases the tree may have. But outside of doing increment bores and, you know, soil pits, looking at the root structures, it becomes very invasive to the tree. So we try to do a total visual inspection with those indicator things that I just pointed out as our targets, you know, our highlights. What are we looking for here? And then, of course, you work with the landowner. So I know those locust trees you're talking about. Locust wood is very strong and twisty, and they generally last for a while. So if they're that big, they've withstood quite a few storms over the years. So we take that into account too, the size and health of the tree as a total package. Now, if we start seeing, you know, the top dieback, some crown dieback, you start seeing more deadwood in the tree, elms, for example, Dutch elm disease. Elm is a very strong wood, but once Dutch elm disease hits, you know, the wood becomes brittle and becomes, you know, a public safety hazard as well as a hazard to the power line. So to answer your question in short, yes, we do look at the tree's health and the indicators to try to help us direct if we go after a tree in particular. And then we try to coax the customer with the tree replacement program. I don't know. There's quite a few. We've got several that we've done this year, a couple over in Cole Harbor. And again, even with our widening program, the trade-off is, you let us cut this, we'll give you that. And we end up planting 20 or 30 trees for a customer to hide a screen, you know, to plant in front of their house in exchange for this aesthetically unpleasing thing that we just did. You know, it's a trade-off.
Well, just to further that a little bit, the locust trees there, all almost every storm I'm up there, this branches, you know, they have weak branches.
Yep.
That's one thing that seems to come along with
yep.
it. You see them laying all over the road.
That's
everywhere,
right. Yep.
Every time there's a storm.
Yep.
I don't always think of a locust as really being a pretty tree or things like that. But you try to encourage replacements on some
ones we want to target. Yeah. Now, the Freeman Lumber folks, we've met with those folks in the past as well. We did a tree removal program where the feeder that fed that mill was in beautiful shape, but it had so many dead pine on the edge of the road that sat 10, 15 feet back that maybe no one would really pay attention to driving through. We took down 30 or 40 of those because they were falling in on the line from the outside edge. You know, so we do target specific species of trees. Locust sometimes is a target depending on where it's located.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Councilor Johnson?
Well, from my perspective is, if you don't take anything else away today, I was really encouraged to hear that trim cycle is down to 5 to 7 years because, you know, with the way things are growing, the summers we have, it's great. And from firsthand experience, I'll tell you, like, tree-related outages, most of the cases that I run across in your jurisdiction in Nova Scotia are not anything that any trim program would ever correct,
mm-hmm.
unless you wanted to have a moonscape, because
mm-hmm.
tops of the trees, just as you said, 40 and 50 feet away that come down
that's
through
right.
that stuff. Not the regular trim programs. And working in other jurisdictions, up and down the eastern seaboard, man, you guys are way ahead of the game when
mm-hmm.
it comes to those tree-related issues. So, good job, and keep the budget figures there, and keep doing what you're doing, because it will eventually level off. And I see benefits, you know, over the last 10 years from my perspective. Sure. So good job. job on your program.
Thank you very much.
Deputy Mayor McCoy?
I just wanted to say that had you not done the tree work on Bristol and all through Coons County, those two storms that we had would have been very devastating for our area. I know that was a savior for us. It really, really was. Aesthetically or not, I'm sure that what NSPI did was very, 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 very well done. And whether it was the time that, like, I think it's every 10 years or whatever it was to do that, but it was perfect for us because it saved us a lot of power outages and those big lines. Getting back to your tree replacement program, which I was not aware of, and I know in the power bills there's all this little information that can go to vote energy efficiency and all those things. Is it possible, and I don't want to start a whole thing of people wanting their trees replaced, but is it possible to send something out to our customers with that specific program, and whether they qualify or not for that? Because it would be a real type, you know, really something well used.
Yeah, we can talk to our communications folks and see if that's the right direction to go.
Yeah, that's not something we can answer here.
Yeah,
but
I will
100% we'll bring that back
to
our communications group and pitch that to them.
Yeah.
So far, it's more of it's been a targeted approach. So
right.
We want something, and we're willing to replace something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's kind of where it's been at. But you know, it does exist. It's not, you know, that public as far as, you know, this is what we're offering everybody.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
yeah, of course. Yeah,
it's going to be a case-by-case basis, mm-hmm. and usually there has to be a mutual benefit as far as.
But I often wonder, there are probably a lot of trees that are close to your lines that public don't even know that they are dangerous or that they can potentially cause an outage. And I think it'll just make people more aware of looking at the properties and assessing them and the type of trees. And it's interesting, you know, the type of trees that are stronger and you know, certainly will not branches will not fall off on lines in heavy winds. But it's interesting to know all the scientific stuff because it really helped for a homeowner to know that.
Yeah.
And prevent it as well.
The ice storms are really difficult.
Yep.
They're just really, really difficult. I mean, we can manage a little bit for wind and snow loading, but the ice is what really sets us back as far as how far is too far. You know, there's a line in the sand you got to draw somewhere about how wide our right-of-ways can be, because let's face it, when you get an ice-laden tree top, it buckles over. And when the ice is released, it flips back up again. So like 2 days later, you didn't see anything. But, you know, Pictou County is a prime example. 2 years ago, they got nailed with two or three ice storms back-to-back. I mean, we invested a lot of money widening and doing just exactly what we did here. And these last two storms,
yep.
they came out smelling like a rose. I mean, we did a really, really good job up there as far as getting those right-of-ways open.
That's the preventive measures program.
Yep, exactly. Yep. Now we just have to maintain it.
Councilor Fish?
Well, very excellent presentation. An eye-opener to me, especially the dollars and cents that is put into the program every year or every 2 years, whatever. Then when Councilor Kelly brought up the underground versus the poles, my God, the difference in pricing. And the customer would have to go with that.
Yeah, so a big part
so
of that, which
no
I...
way that could have been.
Right, which I didn't mention in the first place. We obviously would have to request approval to do that. We're regulated to the URB. We can't decide to bury things underground. So I, from a personal perspective, in my prior job on the capital side, heavily involved in URB applications, I don't think we'd get approval if we were to even ask for it.
And also, you know, an eye-opener to myself, that I've gone down the road and I've complained, why is the power for cutting the street down different than theirs? You've certainly explained out in detail, and I very much understand now how it works.
Good, thanks.
Anyway, just an excellent presentation. I my eyes wide open. Thank you.
Good
you do a good job.
So just to touch on the underground a little bit more, I worked in Vermont for 10 years doing a similar role there, and the question always came up about burying lines. You just think about what's underneath the few inches of topsoil, and there's you know, there's engineering standards to bury this stuff. The cost of just blasting and excavating a trench through granite, sometimes it's just impossible. Vermont's the similar nature, where we have a lot of ledge in the mountainous areas. You just can't physically do it.
Councilor Crowley?
Two things. When you're talking about burying, you know, we've had extensive work done in our town where the streets have been open for the entire summer, dug up. Is there a way to start the process? For example, on Market Street, which is the end of Bristol, we had that opened at one time. Is there a way to start to bury them in towns? I think the question went pretty broad about burying all lines, but in town, is there a way to do that rather than look at the whole project doing it at one time? If we're digging out the streets, is there a way to kind of incorporate them?
So I wouldn't be able to speak to the feasibility or the level of cost savings related to that, but I can get an answer for you.
Okay.
We can find, I'll work with somebody back in Halifax.
I think we've missed the boat on that, but I'm just wondering for future.
Right, but yeah, just for general concept.
Yeah.
My first reaction, I think it's still from a cost perspective. I'm not sure if the URB would be willing to allow us to take a perfectly functioning feeder and spend a bunch of money to put it underground, but I will 100% get you a response to that.
Okay. The second thing that causes a lot of frustration for me, probably for other councillors, are street lights. And I'm not sure if you can answer to any of that, but I've had street lights out of my district for my entire 6 years as a councillor that I've not been able to get replaced. And it reflects badly back on all of us if we can't get this done, because it is one of the things we've been trying to do. We come up with a list every year, ones that are out, we have somebody in the building that will enter those and kind of track them. But for some reason, we just, there's some, especially in rural areas, Western Head is my district, and literally they've been out the entire time. So, and I understand, you know, one of the criteria for reporting is you have to be close to a civic number. Some of them aren't, especially around Western Head. I've tied ribbons on them, I have put posters on them, I've done everything other than get the truck and do it myself.
Don't get the truck. I'll ask you, don't get the truck.
But I don't understand how to get those, that solved.
So same thing, I can take that, I can't speak to that. I will give a little context though. We recently had an application in front of the board related to streetlight replacement enhancements. More of a track. One of our issues right now is we don't have an actual map of all streetlights, like each individual streetlight. So when somebody calls in to report them, when it's not clearly tied to a civic address, like you said, a truck might roll out during the day and they can't tell which one. Or it's happened to us that they've replaced the wrong one. So that somebody sees the truck there, doing some work, goes later that night, it's back. We actually had an application to develop a piece of software that it mapped every single one of them, so somebody could actually go online even and say, or someone, or in this case, I don't know, do you guys own your, are you guys one of the municipalities that own your streetlights?
No.
You're not? Okay, so they're our lights. So you'd be able to go on and actually easily tag which light it is to save that issue. That got rejected by the URB, oddly enough, a few weeks ago. The reasoning was where we're switching to LED lights, the number of replacements will decrease. We disagree with the rejection of it. We think there's still a lot of value. There's a lot of still non-LED lights out there, and there's LED lights are still going to break. But so that's actually a bit of a hindrance to us. But for stuff like that, I'd encourage, obviously, that seems excessive. If there's that many, I'm okay admitting that.
Believes that as well.
Yeah. But if you want to, maybe I'll take your information away from here, and I can get somebody in touch with you related to that. We should be able they should be able to remedy that. But yeah, that's we have issues with our streetlight outage reporting that we were trying to remedy. But even despite that your case, that without knowing anything about it.
One more quick question, if I could. And back to clearing the trees, I know we had a lot of issues down in Port Medway, and I'm wondering, is that contracted out? What happened was they're clearing the side of the road, under the lights, and I'm assuming it's not a special power.
So we don't do anything. It's all, we contract all of our actual work out to Asplund Lucas.
But what was left was just unbelievable that the pictures were going around on social media, and you know, the residents were very upset with the remnants of what was left after it was cleared out. I know that's Councillor Fitz's district. Did you have any conversation with him?
Never had a complaint, one complaint. I might as well be able to say that.
Okay. Well, there were complaints around. So, do you guys follow up on that? If
a complaint or a concern is brought to my attention, I either personally make the phone call myself.
Okay.
We field check every single one. Absolutely. No, we follow up with every complaint or every concern from the customers. Again, sometimes we struggle with some of the TIR mowing on the edge of the roadside because when you see trees cut and there's a power line nearby, well, it's Nova Scotia Power. Well, sometimes it's not us. Sometimes it's another group. So we have to try to do a little bit of investigative work up front, and then once we have an answer or at least some speculation to the answer, we approach the customer to try to resolve it. So.
And this could have been different contractors, because a lot of the times you don't see anything after it's done. It's
mm-hmm.
very clear and cleaned up.
That's right.
This was like the trees were ripped out and just left. The stumps were all torn out, and it was really. Yeah, did you see it? Yeah, and it was.
But nothing made it to me.
That's interesting.
So I'd be more than happy to go and investigate that a little bit further.
It'd be remedied now, I'm not sure. Just wondering the procedure.
Put it into context, the equipment utilized was a piece of equipment with a grinder head, and the stumps were left 3 feet high.
Okay.
It was visually offensive to residents, and
so
concerns of the height of the stumps up there.
3 feet clearly is not within our spec.
Well, again, it could be transportation instead of Nova Scotia Power.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. TIR are notorious for leaving stumps knee height. And we kind of get lumped in with that sometimes, but that's absolutely not part of our spec to leave stumps that high.
And even if it is our job, and it's despite it being a contractor doing the job, we consider that. Like I don't want that to come across as in it was one of our contractors who did it if it was our job, but it falls under responsibility whether it's Asplund or Lucas doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are times when we have a multi-phase approach to our program. So there's a piece of equipment that might come in and top out, but it'll clearly be much taller than 3 feet. You know, you're talking 6-7, you know, just around telephone height. And then we'd have another piece of machinery come down and get the material to the ground. So I just want to make sure that we're pretty clear that we do have times where, you know, we do leave a big mess, but we know we're leaving a mess, and we're going to come back to clean it up because we have more work to do.
Thank you. Councillor Kelly?
Yeah, just to finish off, and a lot of times I get asked, you know, made comments by my residents to say, why don't they put the lines underground? Because they come from Europe, or they come from outside of Nova Scotia where they actually do that. So what is the difference between Nova Scotia doing it and then costing more than what we do to maintain our lines now than it would for other countries?
So I can't speak to other jurisdictions on what the costs are there. My first, I would say there's probably 2 points. Our soil features are very rocky, as Jason mentioned, would increase costs, I'm sure. And we're very open with the fact that we have, although rates over in Europe are obviously in many cases 3 to 4 times what we pay.
Okay.
So the acceptance to pay higher power rates for stuff like that, for much, obviously they have, they do their cleaner, more renewable energy than we are. They pay very high for that. I think a lot of they use a lot less energy than we do, so they're more apt to it. But yeah, as everybody here knows, we're under a lot of pressure to keep rates stable, which we've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years. But yeah, I think the acceptance to increase rates to pay for it, my personal guess would.
Johnson.
I think this is more of a comment for staff and around this room is the idea of missing the boat on the School Street Main Street project. I think what we have to do from a public works and a planning perspective is start looking at that 5-year plan, because you cannot, there's more to it than just burying what's along the street. You got to get to the houses, and there's a whole piece of engineering from that side of it.
Yeah.
We got to look a lot further out than what's in our immediate future. Next year, there's no way we can expect the utility of any utility to come in and catch up to that.
Yep.
Our communication, and we talked about communication earlier, needs to be pushed out from those capital projects a whole lot more, and we might be able to capitalize on some opportunities. But telling them now that next year we're going to dig up this street, that's not going to cut it for anybody. Tell them about communication or whatever. So I just think that's something to take away from staff in that respect.
Thank you, Councillor Johnson. Any other councillor? Councillor Kelly?
And I'd like to add to that as well. I'm just thinking too, with our planning advisory committee, and we're actually going through a review right now of our planning strategy, and if we could actually incorporate something along the lines of trees that can get planted along a certain edge of roads or near power lines or things like that, and what type of trees can be planted. I did a walk around my district not so long ago, and people are planting trees in places where not only are they right next to power poles, but also they probably don't realize, maybe somebody just gave them the tree. They have no idea what kind of a tree it is, but at some point, like in the next 5 years, nobody's even going to be able to see down the road, and then someone's going to have to come along and cut it down, because it's going to take away the visibility of actually being able to travel on our streets as well. So I think there's a lot to do with trees and what people know that they are planting and where they can plant them to make this whole job a lot easier for everybody.
We struggle with it every day.
There you go. So
HRM?
Can help with that.
HRM, they're doing it on purpose.
Plant them right underneath the lines.
All right.
So, I mean, there's only so much the utility can push and say, and we understand there's a lot of value to trees in an urban environment, the shade tree component, the aesthetics.
Yeah.
I'm a tree person. I mean, I don't like having trees cut down where they provide a benefit to everybody.
Yeah.
We do our best to try to prevent it, but there's that balance to be had. But again, it's like the right tree, right place.
Yeah.
And education is a big part of it.
Yes.
There is an area on our website where we do have a list of compatible tree species. So there's 20 or 30 on the list, and generally what makes them compatible is 20 feet or less, because generally our power is higher than 20 feet.
Right.
And if the max can be at 20 or just below that, the maintenance of it is basically non-existent.
Right.
So it just never gets to be a problem.
Yeah.
There's times when you can, the municipalities can train trees. If you want to plant a tree that you know it's going to potentially reach that height, having an earlier maintenance or pruning program can help direct the branches to grow away from. So there are techniques around that. So it boils down to how aggressive the planting people are in towns and how the finances too. You got to have someone to do it. So.
Yeah.
Any other councillor have a question or comment today? Councillor Payne? Quayle?
One more negative thing. Sorry. Smart meters, I'm just reading your information you left. There's been a whole movement, and certainly one person locally, that's against smart meters. And I'm not expecting you to tell me why we should or shouldn't. I just wonder, are his concerns at all worthy of looking at? Like, what are the negatives of smart meters?
So
I don't understand it myself.
Yeah, neither one of us are going to speak too technically on that. Do you know what his concerns are?
I did read it, but I haven't read it recently. So,
so there's a couple of different types of smart meters out there. And again, just to touch back on my previous work history, we went through a similar approach. We completely did full smart meter replacement program, and the concerns were very similar there as what I'm kind of hearing trickle in now. So there's initially some concerns about the electromagnetic activity from the meter. Basically, it's been proven to show that it's no more than a cell phone. I'm not a technical expert on it, but these are the feedback questions that we provided to customers in the past about the sort of concerns that around that.
And there was one model, Ontario or Saskatchewan, here, which had fire issues.
Yeah. So the way they work is they just send a signal every so many minutes. Some can be set for every 30 seconds. It's completely up to your brothers and how quickly you want that signal to go back, but it goes to a collector, which can be mounted on a pole, and it works via a cell phone. Since it's set, the signal, how much usage you're using, gets linked to a fiber optic system, and it goes back to a mainframe where you can actually look at real-time usage on your computer. As far as, you know, I had a hot tub at my house, and I could tell when it kicked on because I had this spike, and it was actually really cool to jump on and see where your spikes were throughout the day, and you can modify your behavior to adjust your usage. And it really helps in contract resolution as far as, you know, billing goes. You can go back through time and historically show, you know, customer A, you've used this much power during this time of night, what's going on? Oh, my water heater's faulty, it's been on for 3 days straight. You know, like these sorts of things can be exposed. And then during outages, we know you have an outage before you do, right?
Yeah.
So
the benefits during storms will be very, very large scale for us for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another one, back to the URV project. That's currently before the URV, so the rollout isn't confirmed. We're very confident in the application before them, but it is currently before them for approval.
Thank you both for answering that question, but we're getting a little out of the scope of the presentation, so let's pull it back. Pull it back from the presentation after answering the questions.
Okay, well, I was assuming what you were saying here too. You brought forward your presentation, but you said that there were any other power-related questions you were willing to try to answer.
Yeah.
I spoke to Trevor before, because I have one thing I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
I said, well, if I got the other place asking you here, and he was fine with it. It's just that they could give us any kind of update with the emergency power.
The hydro redevelopment? Yep. So same thing. That's yet to be put towards the URB, but we've given them updates. So currently we are planning to do a full redevelopment of the Mersey hydro system, which will be the replacement of all 6 powerhouses and 12 generating units within each, 2 in each one of them, rebuilding all the dam structures, the 6 dams, and then there's some ancillary substation work that is required alongside it. Current projection is it's going to cost in the neighborhood of $500 million to redevelop it. It's not set in stone. We're hoping to start construction probably in, I don't know if we'll have any actual construction on the ground in 19, but we're hoping to file the first application with the board later this year or early 19. Which will probably mean construction will probably start in 20, if I were to guess. So we're currently working with the First Nations groups to make sure that we've got their full cooperation and support as part of it. That's an ongoing practice now with us on the hydro side, as obviously our hydro systems were their highways. So there's lots of First Nation activity. We don't have the or we don't want to disturb any First Nations historical sites, so we work very closely with all First Nations groups across the province on that. Anything beyond that is still it's still in the project planning stage, but that's the current expectation in our capital plan.
What does that mean for, how long does this project go? I mean, it sounds like a massive project.
It is, yeah. It'll be the biggest hydro project we've ever undertaken at one time. It's probably going to be done over 6 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, likely doing, they'll do it in stages. They'll do a powerhouse and a dam, powerhouse and dam. So they're adjustments. So that way we can still operate the system throughout that whole time with just one powerhouse being down while it's going on.
What does that mean for Liverpool? Like, as far as, you know, we talk a lot about planning and the ability to plan. What does that mean for Liverpool itself, and what are the, you know, what things could we expect or take a...
So on the business activity, the economic
or just
spin-off?
Or things like that? Would that all be...
So no, there shouldn't be any, like, way of life changes. Like, you're not going to see, we're not changing the water, how it's flowing. So not, but I don't want to speak to any economic spin-offs or the value of that stuff. I'm not close enough to that on that. But obviously it'll be, we're spending a large chunk of money, so there'll be lots of.
I'm thinking more crews and things like that coming into town. Like that would all be a better issue.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, there'll be large scale contracting crews here doing that.
And I understand, like, well, I was there when they shut the dams down before, and the Mersey River from Milton down was completely drained for a long time. Would that be part of it?
I'm not sure on the actual water requirements that they'll have to do with it. My guess is, I know their intention is to keep operating five of the six powerhouses throughout the whole thing, so I wouldn't think, but I wouldn't want to set that in stone. Not close enough to it.
Okay, so we've got a few questions today. It was a good presentation by Trevor and Jason. I want to thank you both for coming today and entertaining questions. Very appreciated.
Yep, very happy to. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
So we will move on now to 3.0 in camera. A motion to go in camera would be appropriate. Councilor Kelly, seconded by Councilor Kelly. Any discussion? Raise the question. All those in favor? We are in camera and we'll recess for 10 minutes.